Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Formula for Success. I'm David Coulthard, and alongside me, still virtually, thankfully, is Eddie Jordan.
Ah! Oh, your wish could come through, David, because I'm heading home fairly soon. We can go out on those bicycles and drink coffee, and you'll have to see me.
Well, look, EJ, we have a very special guest, don't we, on this show? Someone that has played a large part in your racing career. So I think it's only fitting that you do the introduction.
The introduction goes something like this, that on a recent bike ride, the greatest designer of all time is Adrian Newey, with 25 or whatever world titles to his name. And we were cycling along and having a coffee, and he said, you know something, I've thought about this. The most practical race engineer designer that I have ever seen, and I love his work, what he's done, worked for you, Eddie. And I said, oh, it has to be Gary Anderson. And he said, without any question, this guy is a genius because he has never, ever asked somebody to do something that he couldn't do himself. And ladies and gentlemen, how fortunate, how lucky we are, Mr. Gary Anderson.
Yeah, hi to everybody. Yes, it's a pleasure to be on with you too, I think. As everybody used to say, Eddie.
You might change your opinion later.
We were like two peas out of different pods. So we've always had a bit of a different opinion.
Well, Gary, look, before we unleash Eddie on you, I need to ask, how did you survive working with Eddie? And standout memory from those years?
It was a tough time in motor racing, to be honest. And we started up the Formula One team, so it was not easy at all by any means. But as I say, Eddie used to take me to these meetings to try and drag in sponsorship or whatever. And on the way there, I used to always say to him, Eddie, I only know the truth. I have no idea what you've told these people. So we always had to get our story a little bit straight before we got in the door anywhere. But it was, they were different times. Every day was a new experience.
So, you know, our research tells us that you left Northern Ireland at 19. Like most people from Northern Ireland, you probably, you know, saw the bright lights of Scotland and thought, I'll go there. That's where heaven is on earth. But in actual fact, you had this draw towards motor racing. So take us on that journey from Northern Ireland to where we speak today.
Well, one of the reasons I left Northern Ireland at 19 was I worked in a factory doing maintenance that made chipboard for furniture, and I got sort of crushed one day in a press. I was in a press doing some work on it, putting some new seals into it, and the head of the press started to go up. To go into this press, you put yourself in an asbestos suit, and you crawled down inside it because it was like, you know, steam temperature. It was 100 degrees, so it was very, very hot. And you had a bit of rope tied around your legs, and you had a helper who was outside the press ready to help you get back out again because you couldn't get out on your own. And I felt the head of this press moving, and it was starting to squeeze me a little bit, so I screamed at him to pull me out. Unfortunately, he was a smoker and had gone off for a cigarette, so I was in this press, and there was nobody there to help me. Luckily, somebody else heard me giving a fairly loud scream and pulled me out. So that was the day I decided I need to look at something different. So a friend of mine in Ireland, his brother lived near London, and I said, look, I'm going to go to England. They said, well, why don't you go over and see him? And he works on a building site. So I did the typical Irishman. I come over to England, went to work on a building site for a couple of months. And then that led to other things. And I started working in a garage and blah, blah, blah. And went to the racing school at Brands Hatch and saw racing cars for the first time. And thought, you can actually make a living at this. I wonder if I could get a job in it. So I started work for Brabham about 6 months later.
And that is incredible. Brabham, of course, was owned by Ben Eccleston. So, but back in the day, so you've sort of come up through the hard knocks school of, you know, route towards being a designer. People like EJ, of course, we know has been very entrepreneurial in the way he's built up his business. Bernie, another entrepreneur, you know, motorbike salesman to running one of the biggest sports in the world. So is there a common thread you've seen in someone like EJ and Bernie that you can share with us?
Well, there is a common thread. I mean, they never give up. They always fight for survival. And I think you could say that they probably both like money, so they're fighting for improving their bank balance.
Come on, Gary, that's not true.
No, they like lots of money.
It's interesting. I mean, I worked for Bernie. I started work there in 1972. And, you know, so through Bernie's empire, I suppose you might call it, at that time he owned a Formula One team and he owned, you know, a couple of car dealerships. But as you say, he went on to bigger things and making Formula One into what it is today. So I've seen that. You know, I was involved in that era, I suppose you might call it. And it was a fantastic era because it came from me driving a transit van and trailer with a Formula One car on the back of it to the Monaco Grand Prix, you know, to what we see nowadays. So it's been a great period in Formula One time to see that, see the change in it, you know. We all moan about now it's boring, it's a team dominating, or, you know, we can't work all these hours or we can't do all those races. It's always been tough. You either wanted to do it or you didn't want to do it. And as I say, you know, going from driving that transit van and with a Formula One car in the back and mechanic in the car at the race meeting to getting involved with Eddie to design the first Jordan, it was a massive step for me. It was something that, you know, I could never have dreamt about when I was a kid. I could never have dreamt about getting that opportunity. And, you know, I'm very thankful to Eddie for offering me that opportunity.
These were unbelievable days. You know, I'll tell you a little story about what Bernie said to me one day. He said, "Oh, I hear you got Gary Anderson going up to work for you." And I said, "Yes." He said, "I want to tell you a story about, I was doing something in the Brabham factory and it was a Saturday morning and surprisingly enough, Gary was the only one there and he was around and I wanted to show this Cosworth engine to this potential sponsor." And Bernie sort of just very matter of fact said to Gary, "Get that engine over here," because Bernie thought the engine was on a trolley and it was going to be brought. Gary went over and put his arms around this Cosworth V10 and he actually manhandled it out of, it was not on a trestle or a table. He actually put his arms around it, lifted it up and dragged himself across the floor to show Bernie the engine. And I'm saying, that's Gary Anderson. The guy doesn't realise how strong he is, how talented he is. And, you know, that was often the case with Gary. His belief, he had confidence and belief in himself, but sometimes it was difficult for other people to see how really talented he was.
Just going back to that little story, I mean, I started work at Brabham's. I started work building production cars because we used to build Formula 3 cars, Formula 2 cars, Formula Atlantic for sale, as well as the Formula 1 team. The Formula 1 team was just across the driveway. And I was interested, obviously, in trying to get onto the Formula 1 team. And that's when the thing came up. Eddie, I was involved in Formula 1 before you. It was actually a Cosworth V8. V10s came in a bit later on, but... yeah, Bernie.
I knew you'd always correct me.
Bernie said, "Could you, you know, bring that engine over here and put it in the back of that transit van?" And the boss asks you to do something, and that's your job, isn't it? You know, it's nothing else, so you have to do it somehow. It was one of those sort of things. But by doing it, he turned around to me and said, "Do you want a job in the Formula One team?" And so there I started. I headed off to Monaco in a transit van.
I love that. Great, for any young listeners out there or any young engineers or designers looking to be in Formula One. The work ethic is the thing that's coming through, Gary. You've obviously got skills and talent and vision, but the work ethic is something that sounds like it's brought you to the point where you got that opportunity. If you were mentoring young people today, more than sort of having technical vision or being able to read the regulations to understand what they don't say and find the opportunity in the loopholes, is it the get up before everyone else, get on and you know, only finish when the work's done? Because it seems like a lot of the younger generation today are very motivated by not necessarily not wanting to be interested in the sport, but their lifestyle, their downtime, their social time is very important to them.
Yeah, it's true. You know, I've always had that philosophy in life. If you can't do it yourself, you shouldn't ask somebody else to do it. I think that's very important. You know, we've got lots and lots and lots of clever people. But, you know, you said something there earlier, David, about, you know, vision. I think that's what you have to have. No matter what era it was in Formula One, you know, you need to have a bit of a vision of what you're trying to build. And that's what the old Formula One gave you. Everybody contributed towards the end result of a car going around the track. It wasn't just about sitting in your office with your head stuck in a computer drawing stuff. And, you know, nowadays I think you get a lot of people who don't see past that computer screen, and that's really a difficult place to be. I think experience counts for a hell of a lot, and I still feel that you need that gut feel. And I think that's one thing that Adrian Newey has. He has that gut feel about how a car should feel to the driver. A lot of the other teams miss that gut feel. You know, it's all right proving it all with numbers, but it's not just about that. You know, this is a human being that's driving the car, and you've got to give him confidence. And it's always been the same, no matter whether it was back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, give a driver a car that he's got confidence in, and he'll go quick. And that's how I learned the hard way, was just the fact of doing things wrong, I suppose you might call it, and then having to react to it. And you learn by that. You have to sometimes step back out of the forest to see the trees. And, you know, I don't think many people do that.
So it sounds to me, Gary, that irrespective of the technologies that are around, and we're on the, you know, AI is with us now, and I dare say there's probably with AI, you can slot in all of the technical information and directives, and it would come out with a Grand Prix car of a sort. And maybe it would be at the peak of everything within those technical capabilities. But as you say, if that peak of performance is undrivable because it only operates within, you know, ideal conditions, which means there's no tailwind and there's no curb that the driver's rattling over, would your message be really to the younger people coming up to be out there with your Formula Fords or your touring cars, your club racing, getting their hands dirty, looking at problems, you know, fabricating, you know, really having that vision of what the vehicle has to do?
Yes, I think it's very important. There's no excuse, there's no shortcut for a bit of experience. And even down to the fact of having a little pedal in a car yourself, even if it's only a track day or something in a road car, just get into it and just see what it's like to drive the car around a racetrack, braking, accelerating, and, you know, try to go faster. You don't have to go out and kill yourself, but at the end of the day, just that little bit of experience of driving gives you an idea of, you know, how you feel the brakes or how you feel the car. But experience is everything. Go to a race meeting, get involved with a Formula 3 team or whatever team, and just experience how difficult it is when the guy, you know, has a problem with the car that, you know, you need to try and scratch your head and try and fix. You know, get that experience, because it gives you a different grounding whenever you're sitting there trying to design someone. How practical is it to change the springs on the car or the torsion bars as they are nowadays? You know, Eddie and I went through, we met first of all doing Formula 3 in Europe, you know, and that was, again, a van driving to races in Europe, you know, living rough as such, but really, really taking in what it took to go motor racing. And that's really how we got to know each other in depth. You know, it went from Formula 3 to Formula 3000 and then obviously to the Jordan F1 car. But all that experience and all those little things that you used to do as a mechanic, I call it an engineer, but as a mechanic in those days, you could dream up changing the suspension geometry, or you could dream up making a different wing for it. And all these one-make formulas now, they stop that, you know. Never mind the breeding ground for drivers, it needs to be a breeding ground for engineers. And that's totally missing. You cannot do your own thing, I suppose, in Formula these days. You can change the springs and the roll bars and all that sort of stuff, but you used to be able to just change the car, and that's the important thing.
So I was always, David, I was considered to be the clown of the team. Myself and Ian Phillips used to go and try and find a sponsorship, and to be best I can remember, I kind of left Gary to do everything because he was so capable and competent of the group of people. I mean, when I think about Gary coming, there was three people who came from Reynard, which Gary said, look, I want to bring these two guys with me. And I said, yeah, fine. And I must say, I'm hugely, hugely impressed at Jordan 191. Gary, I'm not sure if you know, but I should tell you, and I'm absolutely sure that you should know. Motorsport have come out with that magazine, have come out with the best cars in the last 50 years or the last 100 years or something like that. I can't remember, of which your car, the 191, is right there, and is due for an award. So let's see how it goes, because I don't know whether the results are out yet. But just describe how you were given the job when you were doing your Formula 3000. What actually happened to make that car, which for me to this day, I'm biased, still probably the loveliest, most beautiful car that's ever been made?
Well, I mean, it's a long old story, but obviously we did Formula 3000 together, and we won the championship, or Bromley Motorsport won the championship with Roberto Moreno. And then I went to work for Reynard to design the next year's the Formula 3000 car for 1990. And coming up to Christmas of 1989, Eddie said to me, I want to start a Formula One team. I want you to come and design the car. And I thought, he's mad. You know, I definitely thought he's mad. He phoned me a few times at home, and I wouldn't speak to him because I thought it was a crazy idea. But then suddenly thought, well, why shouldn't I, you know? So I said, yeah. And I went to work for him. He told me he had a nice design office and all that place for me to start work. Went to start work on the beginning of February, I think it was 1990. There was nothing, you know, there was absolutely zero. there wasn't even a desk, there wasn't an office, there was not. We actually ended up building the office, first of all, myself, and getting it set up, getting some drawing boards in there, because it was, you know, just about the time of the computer coming in. And Andrew Green and Mark Smith, who worked at Reynard with me, were going to come as well, but they had an extra month's notice to do or something. So I used that time to get the office built, get some equipment in there, get some, you know, magazines on nuts and bolts and washers and circlips, and yeah, because we had zero. And then when they arrived, we started to draw the car, and basically it was doing Formula 3000 race engineering at the race meetings every other weekend or whatever it was, and drawing the car during the week. The weekends that I had off, I would have a drawing board at home. I'd use my weekends off to draw bits for the wind tunnel model. And during the week, we'd draw the car when the three of us were all together in the office. So Andrew was sort of designated with the suspension. Mark was designated with the engine installation and the gearbox. And I did the bit you saw, you know, the aerodynamics and the bodywork and the chassis and whatever.
Can I just ask you about the bits you saw? Because it had a very distinctive nose front wing setup, which set it apart from other cars at that time. And I totally agree with EJ. It's one of the most beautiful Formula One cars of, you know, the history of the sport. How the hell did you, you know, and where do you start, actually? So I want to know about the nose and front wing assembly. But also, when you start to draw some, do you start with the nose? Do you start with the tail? Do you start in the middle?
Well, you know, for me, this is a comment that a lot of people make about Adrian Newey, is that he can see airflow. And basically, when you're drawing something, that's the way you look at it. I still respect Adrian dramatically for drawing things with a pencil, because when you draw things in 2D, you have to think 3D. But when you draw things, when you model it on a 3D, you know, CAD system, you don't. You only do what the software allows you to do. And it's interesting you say that, because the day we sort of started, or more or less the day we sort of started drawing, I had a big layout board. It was the width of the drawing office. And Andrew and Mark, who were cleverer people than me, went off to look at a CAD system. And while they were away, I started to draw out the car, a big side view of the car, side view and plan view. And when they come back, you know, it's 90% done on the drawing board. And they looked at it and said, Jesus, that looks good. So that was my sort of omen to say, okay, it's all right. And as I say, from my point of view, when you're drawing the stuff that you visually see, you have to think airflow. That's what it's about, and how the airflow gets to certain places on the car. And that's what drives it in my book. And I think to this day, it's still exactly the same. There is no difference in it.
I remember when you put that drawing, the full length of it, the drawing office was never large anyway, it was small, but the full real size drawing of this car was on it, and it looked so horny, you have to say it. I said, that is sex on wheels, it's fantastic. But, you know, it's easy, because every child you have, you think it's the most beautiful child in the world. And this was something similar. This was a car that effectively was born out of, it was conceived inside Jordan. The people of Jordan made this car, led by Gary, and the three people effectively that he's talked about. There was a lot of other good people. In fact, there were brilliant engineers that came through that factory brilliant technical people who I talked about. However, it always comes from the top, and that's life in general. It's how the information flows down, the confidence, the calmness, and you got none of that with me. You got all of that from Gary. So I Gary was a much bigger guy. I mean, I think he's probably about twice my weight and certainly twice my size. So I didn't want to have a fight with him unless I had some sort of backup service of other people. Gary is not a guy. Oh, I could tell you some stories about going into France and having a rook in a bar at one evening and Gary saved my life. But anyway, listen, we don't need to talk about things like that on the show because it's all very friendly. But the thing is, yes, I was very impressed with the car. And I remember when it was built, Gary, I don't even think we had enough money to paint it. So we left it in the carbon and it was probably the most beautiful car I've ever seen. And I remember to this day, and we're talking about 1990 now, Auto Hebdo made it their business to come to see the launch of the car, which John Watson was going to drive the car. And I remember reading the article the following week. He was extremely nice, a guy called Jabby Crumback. And he wrote this article. He said, wonderfully made car, elegant in every way, but it's such a shame it'll never see a racetrack. And I said, Jesus, I am going to prove him wrong if ever, ever, whatever. I'm going to draw a breath and make sure that will more than likely see the light of day. And Gary, that went on to finish fifth in the championship in the first year. Michael Schumacher drove the car and everybody remembers that 191. It was just a remarkably brilliant car.
Yeah, I remember at the sort of press release we had, it was in one of Silverstone's sort of lock-up garages. It wasn't as elaborate as some of the later press releases, but we had a group of people there and, you know, one of them said to me, oh, yeah, that front wing is going to fall off, isn't it? And I said, well, why should it fall off? And he said, well, look at it. It gets smaller as it gets to the nose. So as Eddie said there a minute or two ago, I'm probably twice the weight of Eddie. I think that's a bit derogatory, but never mind.
you know, not for the first time.
Nothing changed.
I just stepped onto one side of the front wing, you know, with my fingers crossed at the same time, hoping that it would withstand it. And I said, well, why is it going to fall off? If I can stand on one side of it like that, obviously it's going to take the load, isn't it? So, you know, we didn't have all the equipment that people have nowadays. We had to go out and find suppliers and manufacturers for all the stuff because we didn't have all that manufacturing facility within the place. But one of the things we used to do with the wings, the front wing and rear wing in those days, was to load it up to what we believed from the wind tunnel was the loads it was going to see. And, you know, we didn't have equipment there to put hydraulic rams on it and all that sort of stuff. So we went down to the builder's merchant and got a load of 25 kilogram bags of sand, and you load the wings up with the sand, front and rear wings, to see the deflection and, you know, see they're all adequate and so on and so forth. And, you know, but you find a way to do these things. You have to find a way to do these things when you're a small team coming up and trying to get involved in a, you know, a big format. And this is, you know, I'm very proud of finishing fifth in the championship that year. But the biggest thing for me was, I think Mexico was the first race that I realised we were actually sort of really racing, because through that parabolic of the last corner onto the straight in Mexico, and, you know, you'd get a Williams coming around there and a McLaren and a Benetton or something and a Jordan, and you think, what are we actually doing here? You know, this is actually, we're racing with these big boys. We're not Ausserans anymore. And we just scored points in Montreal, a little bit lucky, but we did score points in Montreal. But Mexico was the first race I sort of thought, oh, this is incredible. You know, we're actually up there giving it the big beans with all these big boys. And that's, you know, that's a turning point for you as a person that's designed the car. The day you realize that actually you're not out there just doing laps, you're actually out there racing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites.
So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
EJ, I wanted to ask you actually, before coming to Gary on this, when you've got a car that's working and you know the whole momentum and potential is there, then of course that's very, you know, it's motivational, isn't it? It's motivational for sponsors and partners and for bringing people to join the team. But when you're going through the difficult periods, and it won't necessarily be about the car, when you've had some times where you've had to run engines because you needed the financial support, and those engines were blowing up in the garage, never mind out on the track. You know, how difficult is that as a team principal to then look to Gary and your design staff who are going, look, we've done our bit, but the bit in the middle that you've signed up is a hand grenade?
What Gary did and the potential of the car was such a relief for me that if the car was going well, it was obviously much easier to sell the sponsorship. But I really very seldom ever, because Gary is a big chap, you don't want to fight with him. So therefore, his view was always the right one when it came to the car. And he never interfered with me on the money. He'd always just say, have we the money to do this? And have we got it? And as you come back to the situation, having finished fifth, the next year was a massive disappointment. But we ran an engine, and I don't want to be critical of Yamaha, but we ran an engine in 92 because they were free, but they were depth charges. I mean, they blew up on the trestles. We didn't even have to go outside the garage and they blew up. But at the end of the day, we got through it, and then we had a magic time with Brian Hart, great friend of Gary's, and then he saved our asses more or less after that. I'll mention something here that perhaps is indicative to people out there when they're talking about stress. The stress on me, and I kept it to myself as much as possible because I never let the financial worries get involved with Gary. He just realised he would do it, and he was so practical, but he was also very cost conscious about it. He'd always go for the cheapest and the best way forward that he could get. And I suffered the most chronic piles that you could ever get. And I was reliably told it's stress. And there's nothing in the world worse than financial stress. And Jesus, we had plenty of financial stress in 92 because it were critical times. I was not a happy person, and I wasn't a good person to be sitting beside either. But you never want to have piles. They are absolutely so painful. Jesus, I couldn't sit down. That was the problem. Anyway, move away from physical things and piles and things. Gary, tell us about it. Because I never really interfered on the technical side, did I? And you never interfered on the money side.
No, just to add to that a little bit, I always wondered why you were sitting in that inner tube up in your office, Eddie. I never was quite sure what it was for. But no, I mean, I looked at all the years and I understood the fact of the financial side. I didn't get involved in it. I tried to be as cost effective as possible, which is all you can do, sometimes to my detriment, to be honest. But that's life. And we all learn something. But I think that both Eddie and I looked at it. We were in it together. You know, sometimes I'd make bad decisions, sometimes Eddie would make bad decisions, but we were in it together. So if we could help each other, we would do. It's as we grew bigger and that, it got more difficult because there was more people to manage, there's more people spending money, there's more people doing things they want to do. So it becomes more and more difficult. When we were small and starting out, we all knew our responsibilities and we got on with it just. So Eddie had his stresses, I had my stresses. You know, if we take the Jordan 191, it was probably November of 1990 before Eddie walked out into the office and said to me, I think I got the sponsorship to go racing. It might even have been later than that, the end of November. Because, you know, all the way through building the car, I never really, really thought we'd go racing. I thought we were doing this, you know, this design project to get it together. And then whenever it ran at Silverstone and, you know, the car in black and it looked really good, you thought, oh, that's such a waste of time if it doesn't go racing. And then one day Eddie clicked on to finding the right sort of money to actually start the team and put it together and go racing. So that was a big, big day for me to realise that actually what we'd created over the last 9 months was going to be used in the heat of battle. It was a big wake-up call.
So question to you, both really, modern Formula One, Adrian's been very critical of the regulations and that he feels that it stifles a lot of ingenuity. And I get it from one point of view, but it doesn't stop him and the design team that work with him in looking at those regs and making the best of what they've got. if you look at, and we touched on a previous podcast, Eddie and I, about the plight of Alpine right now. They seem to have a heavy car, they seem to have an underpowered engine, and an unstable aerodynamic platform. So bring all those three things together and you have, you know, racing hell. So could you too be deployed there and turn that team around, given that we've got people of a similar generation of yourself, Gary and Eddie, that are still operational within the sport? And would you, if that call came, or would you both go, not a hope in hell? Or, you know, I don't know who wants to lead with that first, but do you understand the question I'm asking you if you look at modern Formula One and the plight of, say, an Alpine?
I would say no, immediately from my point of view. However, on saying that, I think that it's the philosophy of the car. You know, like I said about the 191, you know, you get your mind set as to what you want to create with a car, and you go off and achieve that. And that's what I call the philosophy. Now, you have, in those days, it was me. You know, I'd think about what I wanted, and then I'd go to the wind tunnel and try and get it. So it was me just trying to accept my own requirements. And stability was one of my things, and sensitivity was another, you know, very, very important to me. So what I'm saying is, for Alpine right now, and for quite a few teams, to be honest, it starts at the top. It's setting the philosophy out of what the car needs to be competitive. Now, we know the car's overweight. That's one thing. That's just a number, you know, 0.3 seconds per 10 kilograms. You can't do much about that other than make the car lighter. So that's just an engineering challenge. There's nothing tricky about that. The other part's the performance. You need to have an aerodynamic philosophy as what you're trying to do with a car. And then you have got probably 100 people setting off to try and achieve that. If nobody sets that philosophy, there's 100 guys going off just randomly trying to find a solution to a problem that they don't really understand. So I think that could be fixed. And I would be very happy to say that I think I could contribute towards setting that philosophy, not necessarily achieving it, because you have so many more tools now than I was ever used to. But for a racing driver in a car, the philosophy still stays the same. He wants a car that's stable. He wants a car that's consistent. He wants downforce that he can use. This peaky stuff is just a waste of time. And as I say, that's not just Alpine. There's a lot of teams out there struggling with the same thing.
Yeah, well, I agree. Peaky stuff is definitely not good, unless it's Peaky Blinders, of which is a brilliant, brilliant series. EJ, would you rise to the call if they said, come back from South Africa, Alpine needs you?
Here's my philosophy on that. When Gary had a question, and it was a question of money or a different thought process of what would... We would either sit in my place, or I'd go down to his office, or we'd go out and have a pint. And I think a pint is a great solution in many respects, because you're able to talk about things and then come back to it and then go again. And you kind of have that feeling of friendship. And that was the way, great thing about Gary had these guys, all brilliant young engineers, and they revered him. And yes, we took them out of universities, and yes, we got them on the cheap, but they earned and learned so much that when they went on to bigger and better things, there was always a stamp on it, trained by Gary Anderson, so to speak, or trained by Jordan, it doesn't matter, but it had that imprimatur on their CV. Now, I don't see how I could do that. Jordan was very fussy. It never had another shareholder, apart from one small time when there was an American guy who gave me a load of money and I gave him a shareholding, but I bought it back because I couldn't cope with it. Now, if it was me and Alpine, I could not cope with Renault, with the way they are looking at their involvement in Formula One, their haphazard way. I feel that there is no direction. I think that there is no push. I don't think there's enough money. I think they've got great drivers and they've got a team. It's such a shambolic situation to see how bad that car is at the moment. And it needs somebody like a Gary Anderson to go in there, kick ass, and go from the top and say, I'm sorry, it has to be like this. And that's the way Gary is. Gary comes across as very mild and mellow, but I'm telling you, you don't want to be on the wrong side of him, because it's a big growl. And he is a very serious guy. And as I said, listen, I was a clown and he was the hardcore performance person who drove the team on. But me having Gary, I always knew that the car was always going to be well prepared, it was always going to be competitive, and the drivers would have a decent chance to perform. I don't see that in Alpine. I don't think that's an easy fix. I think to have big sugar daddy over your head like Renault when they probably don't really want to be in there. And I don't see any reason. I think they will sell the team. I really do think they'll sell the team. And it might be an answer for Andretti in the future. Incidentally, I think we'll ask Gary about the situation in Andretti because he knows more about American-style racing, having been with Gallus in IndyCar Championship and, of course, bringing Roberto Moreno, who was brilliant, winning championship not just in Formula 3000 but also over there. Gary, just some of your thoughts on the, what would Andretti do, you think, in Formula 1?
Well, I think Formula 1 needs more teams for a start because, you know, 10 teams, they're obviously earning quite well out of Formula 1 now and, you know, the revenues got higher and higher and higher. But I think we need more depth because we need to bring in more drivers. I think Andretti has obviously got credentials from his from the IndyCar racing and all the other stuff he does. Are they good enough for Formula One? They're good enough to have a go at Formula One. I think there should be no, you know, golden goose, I think, for new teams coming in. They shouldn't be, you know, they shouldn't get prize money for a couple of years, Eddie. I think you went through that whenever we started. You didn't get paid, really. But, you know, if we go back to whenever we had, 12 teams in Formula One, you know, it's 10 years ago now, roughly. You know, out of that, those 12 teams, 8 of the head honchos in those teams, as far as the technical side was concerned, either head of aerodynamics or technical director, all came through the Jordan School of Motor, as I like to call it. And that was a very proud moment, you know, that from my point of view, that we brought on engineers, etc., that headed up all these other teams, some of them successfully and some of them not successfully. But that's important, and I think it's important that there's a challenge. We always want to see the cream rise to the top, but at the minute, it just seems to be stuck. And we need more teams in there to weigh out the teams at the back. Are they good enough to be in Formula One or are they not? So you need another competitive team or two to come in and sort of weed out the back end. Not necessarily challenge at the front, because I think that would take years to achieve nowadays. But we need the competition, and Andretti could be one of those.
So we've got Andretti still knocking on the door. We've got Audi fully announcing that they are the full owners of Sauber, so no big surprise in that. What do you reckon the chances are of an Audi based out of Switzerland really, you know, winning a world championship? Ultimately, that's got to be their goal. I don't doubt that they've got the credentials to build a good race car and maybe compete for wins. But how big a difficulty, Gary, do you see it in operating out of Switzerland when the majority of the Formula One, you know, Silicon Valley is in the UK? There obviously is two teams outside, Ferrari and RB. Is that a challenge you think that they can overcome, or is that just old school thinking that it will be difficult for them to make it happen from there?
I think it's, you know, it's another sort of notch in the challenge post. You know, you look at it and you think, right, okay, building the car, building the engine, doing all that sort of stuff in Switzerland is no easy task. But you just sort of cut off from, as you say, Silicon Valley, from the contacts, the people, the rumour mill down the pub, you know, all that stuff is different. And so much of that does work, whether you like it or not. You know, all these people know each other at race meetings, but, you know, a few of them meet up for a barbecue or a beer here and there, and, you know, somebody will say something, or you want to employ somebody, you know, you set the seeds in motion. Now, I already have a fairly decent success rate in motorsport in everything they've done so far, but, you know, they're taking over a team now that exists in Sauber, and obviously Sauber, as it is now, is they've been fighting a battle for quite a few years. They haven't really sort of stepped up. And that's one of the teams that I'm talking about as being questionable, whether they justify their existence as they stand at this point in time in Formula One. And that's where a team like Andretti coming in would sort of maybe send some shockwaves down that end of the grid.
I think what it does is represent, Eddie, if I recall correctly, were friends of, or you certainly had admiration for Peter Sauber and what he'd built there and achieved over the years. Am I right in saying that? Peter was someone that you knew reasonably well?
Absolutely love the man. I think I was paired against him because it was a choice in 1990 when I brought the car. I think Gary will remember, we went to Rickard to do a test and we knew that this guy called Matasic was flying in to have a look. And we were really quick with that car, but Matasic went with Peter Sauber. Peter Sauber is one of the all-time nicest people that you're likely to meet in Formula One. And that possibly is the very reason why he never won a Grand Prix. Now, the reality is, Peter Sauber, the setup, the mindset, it's wrong. Gary is absolutely right. There is no chance that Audi are going to win Grand Prix. I think we're living in fantasy land.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see and to watch. They've got a number of people that have got experience in Formula One involved in trying to, you know, create their future success. Gary, I wonder if you can share with not only me, but the fans of Formula One. I sometimes struggle to explain why, you know, Mercedes had their period of dominance and Ferrari had their period of dominance and Red Bull are having it right now. How do we explain when the regulations are largely speaking the same as they have been for the last few years? I know there was that, you know, big step change where the underfloor became a much bigger part of the aerodynamic performance of the car. But in the hybrid era, Mercedes were getting things right. And then the last couple of years, they haven't been getting as much out of the aerodynamic regulations as others. What is it, if you don't have a change in technical leadership and you've got largely the same group of people there, what is it that changes now? You know, I use the expression that I've picked up from some quote, I think it was from Bill Gates, who said that success is a lousy teacher. It makes people think they can't fail, and therefore sometimes you get a little bit of complacency in there. But can you put more meat on the bone? Because I struggle to articulate what it is that changes success within the same organisation when you've got largely the same group of people.
Well, I think you do find that. I think it's a bit like even going back through the Jordan days. You know, as we got bigger, my job changed a bit. My job changed to sort of managing more than doing. Of the cars that we had, you know, the 91 Jordan, the 94 Jordan, and the 97 Jordan, they were three cars that I would say I knew every nut and bolt on them. You know, I knew the reason for the suspension geometry to be the way it was, the steering geometry, the, you know, the aerodynamic characteristics of the car. I did the wind tunnel work on those three cars. But as time went past, you end up having other responsibilities. And, you know, if you take 91, then suddenly we had the Yamaha, and it was blowing up all the time. So a lot of time was spent with Yamaha. Then 93 was building up again to try and get money back in again, and it was about focusing with Brian Hart on working with him to get the engine to be at a level that we needed it to be. And then 94 we changed to Peugeot, and again I spent a lot of time in Peugeot. The thing was so unreliable to begin with, it was unbelievable. And you know, you expect these engine companies to actually do the job and fix it themselves, but they don't. So those things really hurt me. And as I say, I think if you've got the mindset that, you know, you look at airflow and you design the car to suit, then your success is okay. But suddenly as you are successful, it gets passed on to other people. They start taking over from you. And I think that's what's happened to Mercedes. You know, they had successful years. They obviously had a good understanding of the hybrid engine before anybody else. So 2014 to 2020, you could probably take away three or four of those years as being dominated by the hybrid package they had. And the car wasn't necessarily better than other cars, it just happened to have a better hybrid package. But they did have good chassis years as well, or competitive chassis years. So whenever Red Bull got their act together and, you know, got a decent engine package in there, a hybrid package in there, they started to nip away at Mercedes. So I don't think Mercedes ever had a dominant chassis. But the fact that the car is produced now, you know, 70-75% of the downforce from the underfloor of the car, that's a whole different philosophy, you know. And I go back to my time in IndyCar that Eddie was talking about earlier in the 80s. And there was one bloke there that sort of designed IndyCars and got involved, and they were all ground effect cars. And his name happened to be Adrian Newey. And, you know, he was there at that point in time. That's a lot of years ago now. And I think just Adrian has a better understanding of that. Mercedes, as you say, they lived on their laurels for too long. They didn't recognise their own deficit and the fact that their main positive was the hybrid unit, and the chassis was okay, but it wasn't special. And as soon as somebody else got as good a power unit, or as soon as the engine regulations sort of equalised themselves, then suddenly they're being caught. And then it's all down to the chassis, because you can't just turn up more power.
So at this point, I'm going to thank our listeners for joining us here in Formula for Success, reminding them that they can subscribe to FFS wherever they listen to the podcast. And if you'd like to support the podcast, please share it with others and leave us a review and a rating, being kind to EJ, because I know he is the weak link in this. And you can follow us on social media.
Thank you,
with
David.
The handle at F1 for Success. EJ, you know I love you. Gary, absolutely loved having this conversation. And it'd be great if we could invite you to maybe join us again later in the year to expand further on the current state of Formula One. But some wonderful stories from the past. EJ, have you got any sign-offs or any final points you'd like to raise with Gary before we wrap this one?
Not really, but it's an absolute joy. I know the family, we've grown up together. I remember when Gary asked for some time off to go and build a build. He built the whole house for Charlotte, his daughter. That was great. But my other memories was, I always felt so brave going into a pub with Gary, and particularly in France when they used to get a bit snotty when we'd be drinking the schnapps and various other things after our day's racing. If anyone ever put a hand on me, I just used to look at Gary and they'd look at him, and everything mellowed away into tranquility. It was great. Gary, I love you, brother. Thank you for the years that you brought to us. Such fun, such joy. I absolutely love hearing from you. It's fantastic.
It's great to talk to you, Eddie. I hope you're well, and you, DC, and I hope the listeners enjoyed our little bit of banter here and there, because it's important. One of my challenges in life since I stopped Formula One is to try to bring Formula One to the people, because we're a bit closer to it than they are, and they deserve to understand it a bit better. And I enjoy doing that. So for the listeners, I hope they've got a little bit out of that.
Excellent. Gary, thank you so much.
DC, am I able to... My growl, DC?
Yes. Our sign-off. Prepare yourself, Gary.
Gary, you and the family. There you go. Thanks, everybody.
Nutter.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.